Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Edward Humes and Pat Morrison to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you. Hello.
Thank you all for being here.
When I was reading this book, Ed, I was thinking that I should really show it to my neighbors, because my neighbors think I'm an environmental extremist because, among other things, I sort their garbage. Blue bin, people, blue bin. And yet these are people who committed such massive amounts of their attention, their energy, and really refocusing what they thought was important in their lives and in the world. And the only phrase that came to mind to describe the people you're talking about in the book is the phrase from the Founding Fathers about their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Who are these people?
Well, I think that sums it up really, really well. It's a range of people, unlikely characters like the founder of Esprit. I mean, here's a guy who devoted himself to a global enterprise that really tore down many of the things that he's come to want to rescue, and expending fabulous sums of money to save rainforests in Patagonia and to fund environmental groups here. I mean, you would never have pegged him for the guy that evolves into this. And then two of my favorite characters are a couple of owl hooters. For the U.S. Forest Service, these guys.
Yeah, how many people picked up this book and saw the Hooters chapter? The Hooters. And just bought it because of that. Huh?
Well, it was open. You know? Well, it's a different kind of hooting. They would go out into the forest in New Mexico, in the Gila National Forest, and they would hoot like owls because this was a region where the Mexican spotted owl lived, and it was an endangered species. It was also the immediate era after James Watt and Ronald Reagan turned our U.S. forests into a wood shop. And the only restraint on this particular area for clear-cutting the public lands was the presence of these endangered owls. So they'd go out at night, and if you did it really well, they would respond to your hoots. They'd even take a dead mouse out of your hand if you were lucky enough to be able to coax them into that lovely experience. And sure enough, these two guys, Kieran Suckling, Peter Galvin, came across some owls in an area of the forest, and they had been tromping under the moonlight for hours and weren't quite sure where they were, and they raced back to find out that they were in the middle of the biggest timber sale in the history of this particular forest, slated to begin within the month. So they called their superiors and said, "We got to put a stop to this. There's owls here. You need to protect their habitats." I said, "Hey, you got to be kidding. But this is the biggest timber sale in history in this region. We're not going to stop it for a couple of owls. And you." So they quit, and instead of becoming government hooters, they became, private howlers, you would call them, and started using whatever legal tools they could find to undo the damage they were witnessing to species and to forests. And it snowballed from there.
These people reached a kind of tipping point, and it turns out that they were not afraid of being called extremists, and they had to put up with all kinds of accusations about conspiracy theories. All of us like to think that we're socially aware and socially conscious. You write a check, you go clean up the LA River once a year. What is the tipping point that takes someone from that kind of passive benevolence into the absolute full-throated activism with checkbook that you're talking about here?
I think it's for each of them, it was an ability to step out of the mainstream and kind of see the insanity of the way we live, the wastefulness or the destructiveness. I mean, we don't see it. I started dimly perceiving things the way some of these echo barons do, just by hanging out with them. You know, and just a little example. I mean, we use more energy and more fresh water to transport, you know, to flush our toilets, basically, than most countries in the world have to drink. We don't even think about that. I mean, these guys have been thinking about things like this for decades. You drive in the car with him, and you say, oh, you see that? And it just looks like a patch of weeds or a stand of trees. That's where, you know, this endangered bird is nesting, and it's slated for a shopping mall. Can you believe that? We're blind to the things that they have been living and breathing for many years. The great thing about the people I got to know through working on this book is they're not throwing up their hands at the this environmental bad news that's bludgeoning us all the time. You know, the climate and the deforestation and the dying oceans. I saw an inconvenient truth and I felt paralyzed by it. I don't know about you guys. It was just, well, we're screwed. What are we going to do? And these guys say, we're going to do something. It's really quite incredible. It's very. I'm much more hopeful about where we're headed now than I was before I undertook this book, just by dint of the force of personality of these people that will not say it's too late to act. They'll just go and take on these projects.
And I have to say what a remarkable thing this is, because both Ed and I, as journalists of long standing, this isn't what you do. And as time goes by, you get more suspicious and maybe a little more questioning of people's motives. And to find people like this who are clear-sighted and wholly committed to what they're doing and aren't cynical but are realistic about the process of doing it is probably really gratifying. You needed one of these after some of the books you've been doing.
I did. I had just come off a book about the evolution wars, and it was kind of horrifying to see this alternate universe of anti-science that was going to work in our schools. And now to meet, you know, a guy like Doug Tompkins, who made a fortune. Well, actually, he founded the North Face, then he founded Esprit, and then he's been living like a monk in Central America, in Patagonia. Between he and his wife, who turns out to have been formerly the CEO of the company Patagonia, have saved something like 2 million acres of rainforest, and more than any individuals on the planet.
Well, let's talk through Doug's story. So Doug is in San Francisco, 1960s, 1970s. They come up with all these cute little dresses, and they sell them out of their VW van, I can't remember. But
yes,
that's
the
what
back
it
of
seems
their
like.
Station. Right.
So the cliche comes true. And then what is the epiphany for somebody like that to say, you know, I could buy a yacht, I could be living on Russian Hill, I could have the best house and the best of everything, but something turned his head around, though. What was it?
Well, his roots are as a mountain climber. A serious climber, and he also was a contender, though he didn't make it, for the Olympic ski team. So he's an outdoorsman. And he says, you know, the only time I really feel at peace is when I'm outside and, you know, perched on a cliff, getting ready to, you know, make the ascent to the summit on some mountain in the middle of nowhere, more often than not in South America. So his passion was for nature. And his first business adventure seemed to be in line with that. He started a store, the North Face, which became a larger company, but it began as a store in San Francisco. You know, and they had this great opening day where this band nobody ever heard of called the Grateful Dead played, you know, for the opening of the store, you know, and next to the wine and cheese. It was that era in the Bay Area. And he sold that business because as he described it, he was spending all his time talking about climbing and gear instead of, you know, using it. And he went on this long expedition with Yvon Chouinard to Patagonia, where they had this epic climb that was a documentary was made about it. It was such an epic adventure. And when he returned, his wife had started a business selling clothing, these little frocks and sundresses to department stores out of the back of their station wagon. And so he said, I think this business has some possibility. Maybe I can lend my creative eye to it. And he eventually with his wife, built the Esprit Company and made, you know, huge amounts of money in a global enterprise that was, he began to see over time, was destroying the nature that he so enjoyed and valued. And so he tried within the company to, before anybody had heard of greening business, he started doing it. He used to build his headquarters, recycled timber from old construction in Northern California. He brought it in at great expense, in part because it was beautiful, but in part because he recognized it as an environmental positive. Nobody was doing that then. They thought he was nuts. He would pay his employees to stay away from work and do environmental activism or volunteer work that was in some way green. None of this really satisfied his concerns that he was engaged in a fundamentally destructive activity, and that's when he decided he was going to bail out and sell out and take the money and do something with it. He thought a foundation or a think tank, but then he saw this land in Patagonia and decided instead he was going to go there and see what he could do with his bucks.
He's down there essentially real estate shopping, and he finds out that he could buy 6,000 acres of land for essentially the cost of a condo in San Francisco?
Yes, he could buy a...
Including a volcano.
Including
volcano.
A volcano. He could buy up for the price of a nice condo in the Bay Area. At that time, an area that was larger than San Francisco itself. And he fell in love with it. Well, this is the era after Pinochet had just left office, and the old tyrant had promised all his cronies that there would be huge development in Patagonia. They were going to build this southern highway, and a million Chileans were going to march into this area and make it over. And then, of course, he left office, and all his cronies who had bought up this land suddenly had nothing to do with it, and they were selling it for pennies on the dollar. And in swoops Tompkins with his big checkbook and starts buying up the land. Well, foreigners have been coming to South America and buying up the land to exploit it and extract it and cut it down for many years, and that the expectation was he'd do the same. And then when he told them, no, I'm actually just going to keep it the way it is and eventually donate it for a park, the Chileans did not know what to make of him. In fact, he was greeted with suspicion. He must have an ulterior motive, and the rumors that went around about him.
Yeah, talk about the rumors.
Well, he was a CIA spy. He was building a second Israel, a new homeland for the Jews. He was building a tunnel through the Andes so that the Argentinians could invade, because, of course, Chile's like a pencil, and they're very insecure about their borders. So he'd get up and say, hey, Chris, let's get to work on that tunnel.
Is that
where
they say we're number two?
I'm sorry?
No, pencil joke, sorry. Ticonderoga joke. But they viewed him with alarm, and they were suspicious.
Yes.
They looked
and they
the
still
gift,
are,
horse,
but it's
gift
got
horse
better.
In the mouth.
Yes, because there's no history of that kind of philanthropy in that part of the world, or not much of it. So he was starting a new tradition. But the notion that someone would spend millions of dollars on land and not want to do anything with it except give it away just didn't compute. And there's a history. This every national park in this country started pretty much as a act of private philanthropy. When Rockefeller wanted to donate land for the Grand Tetons, he was burned in effigy in Wyoming, and there was enormous opposition to it. He had to buy the land, much of the land, under an assumed name and dummy corporations, and even after he presented it to FDR to donate it, it was blocked in Congress for a decade. So it's not, now of course they'd burn you in effigy if you wanted to take away the park, but at the outset, I think that the U.S. was in the same position then as Chile and to some extent Argentina, where he's also preserved land, are today. So he was greeted with that same. I don't know if anybody burned him with an effigy, but the military helicopters, were buzzing his house, and there was some bellicose statements made and investigations and so forth.
I want you to talk about the philosophy of deep ecology that many of the people in your book embrace, and why it is seen as radical, why it's seen as a threat in a culture where it's almost a zero-sum notion. It's the land or us. We have our way with it, or it has its way with us, and that there's no boundary. And the idea that what value humans have and what their rights and prerogatives are in this world.
Sure.
Because a lot of these guys, these eco-barons, essentially turned the capitalism from which they had made their money, they turned it on its head when it came to the land.
Yes. And the deep ecology movement is kind of one expression of that, and it's the one that attracted Tompkins when he decided he was going to give up his corporate tycoon existence. He discovered this Norwegian philosopher, Arne Næss's philosophy of deep ecology. And basically, as you say, it turns the typical notion, I think it was Ann Coulter described when she's talking about how she despises environmentalists, about how, you know, God said, here's the earth, rape and pillage it and do what you want with it.
I thought it was because they were going to ban peroxide.
Well.
It'd be the end of it. That too.
If only.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the opposite of that of the drill baby drill attitude, and it's the notion that we humans don't have any inherent right to damage the environment, to damage the planet, except for vital needs. The idea that if it's, instead of saying if it's good, if it's good for GM, it's good for the country. If it's good for humans, it's good for the world. You flip that and you say if it's good for the world, it's good for humanity. That's the philosophy that Tompkins embraced, but its critics would, particularly in Latin America, and particularly in the Catholic Church in Latin America, viewed it as anti-human and anti-life. Oh, so you think that man has no more right to exploit nature than any other creature? So in other words, you don't see humans as special. So in other words, you're denying God. You're denying our place in the order of things. So in some quarters, this was viewed as a very threatening, very radical idea. It depends on how you express it. It can sound very reasonable and common sense, but if you phrase it differently, this idea can really raise the hackles of many people.
And that idea has become institutionalized, and even though it's been secularized in government, it's really been institutionalized in the way that the federal government regards some of its own land, too.
Oh, sure. Well, there's some indications that equation is changing a little bit. But yes, certainly the last 8 years, the environmentalism has pretty much been written off as this radical liberal threat to prosperity, although many of the people that I've written about would argue the converse, that environmentalism can go and should go hand in hand with prosperity.
To what extent, and I was thinking about this in the Doug Tompkins case, to what extent are the stories that you tell here, even though we're dealing with countries that may not necessarily be democracies, to what extent is the fact that these eco-barons have stepped in speak to a failure of democracy to do the job that they set out to do and a success of capitalism as they practiced it and they chose to use their money?
That's the interesting aspect to it, because you normally think of democracy and capitalism as complementary, but in many of the environmental crises that these men and women are dealing with, you see the two ideals clashing. You know, the Center for Biological Diversity that we talked about a moment ago, their big thing is the Endangered Species Act, which it turns out isn't just for protecting spotted owls, but it's for protecting millions of acres of habitat for all kinds of creatures.
And these were the people who really latched onto that notion for the first time.
They were the first ones who saw the power of this law. You know, Warren Berger said it was the most powerful environmental law on the planet, but no one was really using that power until these two, you know, the Hooters came along.
So, when the Endangered Species Act was passed under Richard Nixon, did anybody at the time, you said nobody had a clue about it, was it just about the warm, fuzzy creatures, and then...
Well, no, it was actually about the bald eagle, and its near extinction had convinced Congress and the public that we needed to do something about the extinction crisis. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was also a big impetus for starting to look at this question in a new way. But the law itself, people those who voted for it, and it was unanimously adopted in the Senate, and very little opposition in Congress. And as you said, Nixon signed it and said, "This is our environmental awakening." The idea was it was going to put science in control of the question of protecting species.
That.
Yes. It elevated science over politics. It elevated over economic considerations. Basically, the logic was a shopping mall can come and go, but an extinction is forever. You can't put a monetary value on it because once it's done, it's done. Once the bald eagle is gone, and it almost was, or the California condor still almost gone, you can't bring it back. That was the logic. And everybody thought that made sense. You know, it wasn't until the 80s and Reagan's nine words, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help," the most dangerous words in the English language. It wasn't until then that suddenly this common sense bipartisan idea became a radical crazy idea. So that meant that the Al Hooters were the radicals and the crazies in that construction. They were anti-democratic. They were anti-American. But actually, they weren't outlaws. They were the only people saying, just follow the law. That's all we're asking. And they'd have to go to court and sue our own government to compel them to follow the law.
So they're strict constructionists.
They're strict constructionists.
That's
going to
be big news in a lot of courts.
Well, and you've heard of one of their most recent cases, which was the endangered species protections of the polar bear. These are the people that compelled the Bush administration to admit, A, the sea ice is melting, and B, global warming, which they previously really didn't want to admit existed, was causing it. So that's the threat to the polar bear and to penguins and to other Arctic species. And the notion that the folks at the center have, and now there's more than two Hooters, there's about 65 biologists and lawyers working there, is that the Endangered Species Act is one vehicle for taking action on climate change. And that's what they're now trying to make a case for. And it'll be interesting to see in the new administration how we handle that interesting idea.
There's the Center for Biological Diversity is involving itself with a piece of property not very far from here, the Tejon Ranch.
Correct.
And when some of you may know Tejon Ranch is up over the Grapevine, and the Chandlers, you know, had a big hand in that for a long time.
Interesting history there, yeah.
And where you describe the Tejon Ranch, I can't read it out loud because I'll start crying, but it's so beautiful, the description of how significant. This was the place where the Jodes came over the pass and saw the Central Valley. You know, and Pa Jode said, "God Almighty," and as the book said, he didn't mean it in a blasphemous way. So here's part of what Ed writes about how important the Tejon Ranch is. This last Southern California wilderness is an enormous blank spot on the map, 12 times the size of Manhattan, provides an important barrier against extinction. There is no other place like it in California, and few to rival it on Earth. To stand on a windswept hill at Tejon Ranch is to be at once humbled, enthralled, and saddened by vistas that in years past defined California and the West by their plenty rather than their dearth. The United Nations has recognized the region as a vanishing geographic breed, one of 25 irreplaceable hotspots of biodiversity in the world, a designation reserved for just 2.4% of the Earth's surface. But designation does not necessarily bring preservation. So what's happening with the Tejon Ranch that the Center for Biological Diversity is holding somebody's feet to the fire?
Well, the current owners of that land, which is I guess you'd call it a vulture investment group based in New York, I want to put a new city there between Bakersfield and Los Angeles in this wilderness, a city of about 75,000 people and a resort and an industrial complex and all the things that go with it, which, you know, in this, if you accept climate change as real and you think that sprawl and long commutes and all the things that go with it might be a factor in that, which it is, this kind of development is exactly what we need to stop doing if we want to survive, or at least keep our climate something like what it is now. And so the stage is set for probably the biggest such battle in the country to determine whether nearly extinct condors, because this, among other things, is the historic nesting place for the California condor, where they want to put the resort, and whether greenhouse gas emissions and whether preserving such a rare habitat and wildland should take precedence over what we typically define as progress, which is new houses with great views and good resale value and all those things that we also prize. Well, you know, long after the economy is better, these questions are really going to still be the most important ones we're facing right now. The environmental story is bigger than the economy. It's part of and they're related. And what happens at Tejon Ranch could very well define how the whole country, because California always leads the country on these things, will define how we're going to go forward from here. And whether we're just going to say, the hell with it, you know, the climate can change, you know, our kids can just put on more sunscreen, or whether we're going to change course.
What is the Center for Biological Diversity doing? I mean, there's some mano a mano stuff going on.
Well,
here.
This is fascinating, and you see this pattern because I also found it in Maine with the land up there, where those who want to develop in these sensitive areas turn the environmental community against itself. And this, I mean, it's brilliant tactically.
Divide and conquer.
There's coalition of environmental groups that included the center, it included Sierra Club, included Audubon, and a number of local activists in Kern County and LA County who are concerned about what happens in Tejon because it straddles both counties. And they united to fight this proposal on the grounds that it violated state law and the Endangered Species Act and a number of other powerful environmental regulations. Somewhere along the line, the talks that were initiated to try and maybe settle things between the environmentalists and developers broke down in part because the developers wanted to meet in secret, everything off the record, non-disclosure agreements, and the Center for Biological Diversity bowed out. The other groups reached an accord after that with the developers, which basically amounted to donating a large portion of the land that had relatively low development value but considerable conservation value to the remaining environmental groups, so long as they would not oppose any aspect of the development, the creation of this new city and resort and so forth. Now, the local people who were particularly in the Sierra Club were furious at this. They all resigned. The local board members were felt betrayed because they did not want this development to go through. But, you know, the governor and others descended on Tejon Ranch for a big press conference to announce this epic conservation deal with a big city attached. and only the local environmentalists and the Center for Biological Diversity were left in the camp of saying, This isn't a great feat of conservation and compromise. It's a holocaust, and we're going to fight it as long as we have the ability to do so. So that's where it stands now. They're opposing every step of the way, the granting of what's called a take permit. Do you guys know what a take permit is? This is under the Endangered Species Act. If you want to do a development that might take, which is a euphemism for kill or injure, an endangered species, you have to get a permit to do that. So they've applied for a take permit for the California condor, which the center is fighting. So it's a battle of inches and small steps when being, you know, to try and strike a balance between protecting habitats and species and our traditional notions of, hey, I own the land, I ought to be able to do what I want with it, right? Property rights. So
You write about Richard Pombo, the former congressman who's the foremost exponent of getting rid of the Endangered
Yes.
Species Act and the proponent of the idea of I own it, I can do anything I want to it.
Yes, and it came very close. In 2005, I believe, there was a big push to gut the Endangered Species Act legislatively. And Pombo was spearheading that effort, I think from Tracy, in that not that far from the Tejon Ranch area, I think. And once again, the Center for Biological Diversity was very much active in ginning up support for the Endangered Species Act and mobilizing senators and congressmen, and it was a very close vote. But the attempt to gut it legislatively failed. Of course, immediately, you know, George Bush issued an executive order that sought to do much of the same, and only just recently, last week, one of his rule changes was nullified by the Obama administration. So the pendulum's swinging back the other way now.
You write, you have so many characters who have thrown themselves into this cause. There's one guy, a doctor, who like lives on $20,000 a year and gives the rest of his salary to these causes. Did you like these people, or is it like hanging around with Gandhi if you do it for too long?
I mean,
nice guy, but he never wants to go play pool.
Actually, no, I don't go out for a beer, you know. But of course, okay. You know, electing the guy you want to go out for a beer with hasn't worked out so much for us. So, I think that it varies. In some ways, they're all likable. In some ways, they're so different. They're so plugged into seeing things the way they do that they, you know, you're always on the lookout to see what you're missing when you're around them. But yeah, like Robin Silver is the emergency room doc who for many years just through all, you know, all his other buddies are in the country club and saying, what the hell are you living in that shack for now? And all he wants to do is, it was his name on that Spotted Owl petition that the two Hooters joined, and he would underwrite them with his income from being an emergency room doctor in Phoenix. And he'd send them all their money. And they were living in this cabin in the wilderness for $17 a month, which they were struggling to pay the rent. And that's what, you know, incredible philanthropists they are. They had no money at all because they were spending everything he gave them on their activism. It's a commitment that's humbling to be around. A lot of there's a little confusion about this because what's an echo baron? It must be a really rich person who can afford to do this stuff. And in some cases, the Tompkins, Roxanne Quimby, the founder of Burt's Bees, is also in there. Ted Turner is kind of the obligatory chapter on him because of his enormous work in this area. But the rest of them are quite modest in their means and have had considerable impact. You know, Terry Tamminen's a great story. The pool cleaner who's the architect of our global warming legislation here.
And was the EPA secretary for the governor.
Cal, right? EPA secretary.
Who quotes Shakespeare at length, too.
He's a fascinating...
Pool cleaning Shakespeare quoting EPA secretary.
Yeah, and I've read somewhere, if you look at his resume, it's almost comic because he's pretty much done everything. But his most successful business was as a pool cleaner in Malibu, and he had all these celebrity clients. And then he gave that up. Same thing as the Tompkins. He gave up his enterprise, and he became involved with and eventually the executive director of Santa Monica Baykeeper. And years later, he ran into one of his clients, Dustin Hoffman, who said, hey, I'm glad to see you cleaning the big pool now. And he got to know because the Baykeeper organizations are related to the Riverkeeper organization. So he did some training with Bobby Kennedy Jr. to learn how to be a Baykeeper. And years later, the governor is visiting with his in-laws, contemplating his run for the governorship, and wants to know, hey, Bobby, who should I talk to in California about my environmental policy? And he says, talk to Terry. You know, go talk to the big pool guy. And that's how they hooked up, and I guess they hit it off. All Terry's Democratic friends thought he was insane, and he thought, well, on this issue, we're kind of on the same page, and he's the one that got the ball rolling and essentially designed the big picture aspects of our now world-leading climate change program. Before, and then he sold another Republican governor on it, Charlie Crist in Florida. He calls himself the Johnny Appleseed of climate change. Yeah.
Before we get to Ted Turner, I wanted you to talk a little about Roxanne Quimby, because Burt's Bees, I think people may have made their first acquaintance of it waiting in line at Trader Joe's, and it was a little point-of-sale checkout thing. And now, of course, there's Burt's Bees everywhere. But Roxanne Quimby is another true character.
Yes. Well, and I should, I have a teenage daughter. This is the only person I've ever interviewed that impressed her. You know, Roxanne Quimby, can you bring me anything? It's kind of, yeah, she, very, very interesting story. She lands in Maine, had been headed with her boyfriend to Vermont back in the 70s, and wanted to buy a little land there with their $3,000, and the Vermonter said, you better go to Maine. It's the only place you're going to be able to afford anything. So she did, and they ended up in a cabin out in if you've ever been to Maine, you've never experienced winter. And they, you know, they didn't even have running water. They had a spring that they rocked in, and they'd have to go out and chop it with a hatchet to get their water, and lived a very frugal, very rustic existence. And Roxanne worked from job to job, and then ran into a beekeeper named Bert Javits, who was selling honey out of these old mayonnaise jars, which she thought was kind of unappetizing. So they got to talking. She said, you know, I was an art student in college. Maybe I can design some better packaging for you. And they did, and they forged a partnership. And, you know, she found some cute little containers for him and designed the label, which is still Burt's Bees insignia, the little old-fashioned beehive. And one thing led to another. She became a kind of an apprentice to learn beekeeping, and she looked in his honey house and said, what's all this wax you're keeping here? What are you going to do with this? Oh, I don't know. So she thought, maybe we can do something with this, and that was the birth of lip balm and candles and other things that they would sell at country fairs, and it snowballed from there. She was
at these fairs where she couldn't even afford a motel.
She slept in their van, yeah. And but she was discovered at a craft fair, and I can't remember the name of the famous store.
God, it's the main version of Schwab's drugstore,
yes.
Isn't it? Wow.
And who stumbles on her products but Martha Stewart? And suddenly Burt's Bees is on the Today Show with Martha Stewart saying, I love Burt's Bees, you know, and with a little gift basket. And her company was born and hit the big time. It's one very Horatio Alger type of story. She has since sold her interest a couple times over in the company, and has used her money to, much as the Tompkinses are doing in Patagonia, to accumulate land in the Maine woods, in this area that, you know, Thoreau tromped through and wrote about, you know, with and celebrated, and which in many ways would be recognizable to him today. But that is, like the Tejon Ranch, now under the gun, so to speak, for a new kind of development, not just the traditional timber industry, which is essentially dead, but construction of resorts and houses and towns where nothing but wilderness exists now. And she is doing classic conservation philanthropy, where she's buying up the land and creating preserves in hopes of creating a park or a national monument someday.
Where is that all going to come to when we get to a point where there is a lot of land off limits and people are crowding at the edges and saying, let us in, let us live there, let us cut down trees, let us take the water? Surely they envision that day is going to come somewhere.
Well, this is an area that Maine calls the unorganized territories. It is vast. There are areas of it that cover millions of acres where only 20 people are living. It's not an area that people are clamoring to move in great numbers.
Yeah, they're going to be growing pineapples, though, there in 50 years.
Yeah, my old house in Tucson is going to be beachfront. I know. but it is the largest remaining forest east of the Mississippi. It's a one-of-a-kind territory. Nobody's saying save it all. They just want to keep a piece of it. But the pieces with the greatest conservation value also have the greatest potential for development, and that's the rub.
So are these in perpetuity, these gifts that are given? How long does perpetuity last in the real world?
Well, it depends. If it becomes a national park or monument, it's essentially forever. If it's a private land trust, it depends on how it's structured. Right now, her land is in the form of the latter, but her plans are to eventually turn it over to the federal or state government, and she has already done that to some extent. You know, I didn't know about this. There's these things called inholdings in her national park all over the country, little islands of private property inside the national parks, and apparently there's a couple of unscrupulous developers who have been buying these up and then threatening to erect horrendously inappropriate structures on their land holdings in order to get the feds to buy them at inflated prices. Well, she's been going around, much like Rockefeller did years ago with buyers and under different names and so forth, accumulating these in holdings.
That's what Disney did in Florida.
Yeah. Well, her purpose though is to assemble a portfolio and to turn it over on the 200th anniversary of the national park system to the federal government and give all these in holdings to the parks. So that's pretty cool.
And then Ted Turner, of course, who does live up to the baronial part of Baron.
Indeed. He is, well, he's, I still believe, America's largest individual landowner. And he has these amazing ranches throughout the West and the Southwest that he has devoted to protection of species, sustainable agriculture. He also keeps buffalo on there for his restaurants. And he's been very active in the Yellowstone area doing work actually releasing and rewilding areas where endangered species have been extirpated. In fact, he's taken a lot of heat for this with wolves. But when the when the Interior Department wants to do a wolf release, half the time they'll go to Turner and have his people take care of it because they have the expertise and the history of doing this. So he's really in that case, in the case of his environmentalism, put his money where his mouth is. Tompkins told me, he said, if he would just give up some of his activities, like he doesn't like the buffalo. He feels that Turner would be the greatest wildlands philanthropist in the history of the country, which is saying a lot given our history.
How you mentioned how these people get along or don't get along with environmental groups, especially environmental groups who tend to make pacts with land developers or with politicians. Is the pendulum of public opinion swinging their way at all, or is the deep ecology movement seen as so hostile to human interest that this is where the battleground's going to be?
I think a lot of uncertainty has been added to the picture since the economy went to hell. And there's an argument being advanced that now is not the time to do what's right for the environment. We can't afford it. Now is not the time. Of course, the same people who say that when we're prosperous say now is not the time. We're going to be giving up our edge in the global economy and won't be first anymore. So it's hard to know if there's ever the right time to do what's right for the environment. The counter argument is that the one that Obama's been making, which is renewable energy, reduction of fossil fuel dependence, defining pollution as waste and waste as costly, are all ways of looking at uniting economic recovery and environmental consideration. So which way we're headed, who knows? I mean, we'll know more in 6 months maybe. But the idea that there's aspects of the way we live that are crazy, like, spending 30%, 40% of our water supply to transport our poop. That's insane. Having vehicles that are so grossly inefficient. If you compare the efficiency of the Model T with the average Detroit car today, it's almost unchanged. $8 out of $10 that you spend on gasoline, it doesn't move the car. It's wasted. We only use about 20% of the energy. Who would think of such an insane method of transportation and base your economy on it? We're not even aware just how wasteful we are every day of the week. And I think that is beginning to change and evolve. People are starting to perceive that there is value in not being so wasteful. And when it becomes an economic calculation, that changes everything.
You said that when you saw An Inconvenient Truth, you felt so powerless and hopeless. Did you feel better, differently after doing this, even though you're not a billionaire and don't run Burt's Bees to your daughter's dismay?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't even get any free samples. That's what she said. I do. The conceit behind this book was that the news is so bad, we really need something that's a little more graspable and a little more human and a little hopeful. You know, and it's, if you got a guy like Andy Frank who can take a bunch of college students and a Chevy Suburban and turn it into a vehicle that gets 150 miles per gallon, that gives me hope. I mean, he has no exotic technology, nothing that we couldn't, if we had the will to build, we couldn't be building in mass for everyone to enjoy. I've seen the possibility, you know, that there's a way out of this mess this hole we've dug for ourselves, and the barriers aren't technological, and they're not even economic. The barriers are fear of change. The barriers are not wanting to cannibalize what we've got in favor of something new and uncertain. But these guys seem relatively optimistic over the possibility that we're going to reach that tipping point and make those changes that are going to help us.
I got the sense that no generation owns this. How old? What's the age range of the people you wrote about?
Well, they go from the car guy, Andy. He is in his early 70s. He would be the elder statesman. He is the father of the plug-in hybrid. That's right. He built the first one, patented it, and well, not the first one, but the first modern one. Actually, the hybrid goes back to the earliest cars, but that's another story. And then the youngest ones would be some of the activists at the Center for Biological Diversity, who are in their late 20s and 30s. So, but it's a multi-generational challenge in terms of the environment. You know, it's going to, I see it as it's becoming our World War II. So, you have the older generals, and then you have the younger troops are actually going out and doing the physical work.
But have you changed anything about the way you live after doing this book?
We were already, my family was already on a somewhat green path. You know, Michael Pollan says the best thing you can do for the environment is grow vegetables. Well, we have a vegetable garden that would delight you, because we have shortened the distance between the food and our table quite a bit. You know, I don't take much credit for that. My wife has the green thumb, and I have the shovel. I get to dig the holes. And I live in Seal Beach. It's kind of the last little beach town. So we can walk places and ride our bikes places and keep our cars parked more often than many Southern Californians. That's luck of geography, I suppose, and having thriving local businesses to some extent. So I think we're in some ways above average in our greenosity, and
Doug Tompkins now, after you've spent time with him and with the people in this book, do you see things differently as you drive by? Do you see something that other people don't, because they've shown you how they see?
I think I'm more aware of the wastefulness in our daily lives. You know, I'm ashamed to say, even Walmart's perceived this before I did. They see elimination of waste as a profit maker. Certainly, they're not a completely green enterprise, but they've done some pretty interesting things in terms of shrinking the waste that a big corporation can do. If I can't keep up with that, I guess I'm not doing so well. But I was not aware either of the extinction threat until I started hanging out with the Center for Biological Diversity people, and just how I didn't fully comprehend that we are in the middle of what, you know, paleontologists call an extinction event that we haven't seen since the time when a big meteor hit the Earth and the dinosaurs went extinct. We are in a comparable event right now. The birds, species vanishing at 100 or more times what they call the background extinction rate, which would be the normal rate of extinction you should expect. It's horrifying. One of the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity, Kieran Suckling, is... has been working on his dissertation for his PhD for about 15 years. I guess he's one of those.
Oh, yeah, I know people like
AVD,
that.
Is that the term? And but his he makes a link, he showed me his paper, between the vanishing of biological diversity and the vanishing of linguistic diversity and cultural diversity. So as the natural world shrinks, our own culture and language shrink. And it's horrifying. You know, the great example, the Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the most recognizable piece of music ever, perhaps. You know, dun-dun-dun-dun. That is a mimicking of the call of the wood wren. And in Beethoven, I didn't know this. Maybe I'm extremely ignorant, but I didn't think this was commonly known. But in Beethoven's day, that was completely recognizable. Oh, yes, Beethoven has been mimicking the wood wren.
The wood wren will call upon its lawyers shortly. Yes.
Well, but that knowledge of nature, of seeing an oak or an elm or a maple instead of a tree, we're losing that, and that's part of this destruction of the natural world as well. So the mass extinctions that are going on, part of us is going extinct as well.
Yeah. We want to take your questions, and we have Justin with the microphone to prowl the audience. This is his aerobic moment, so please don't let him down. Let's go right here, the gentleman in the blue shirt first.
Yeah, I guess my question for you is the fight between local government and the federal government. Do you see the people that are adopting things like LEED for buildings locally, is that fight, are they believing what they're doing, or is it a matter of political expediency?
I'm sure it's got to be a mix, and of course you have to put in the state government in that battle too, because you know Jerry Brown's been very very active in using the California Environmental Quality Act to try and push through impact and mitigation of carbon emissions. So I don't know. I've gone to some of these conferences where municipal officials are trying to figure out what the heck they're supposed to do now, I think there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a desire to want to make communities more livable, and part of the equation for that is more green. But mostly it's uncertainty. Now we have this change in leadership in Washington, and perhaps some new direction will be emerging on that front that will clarify some of the concerns. But yeah, I think it's a mixed bag.
Over here, there was a question. Let's go over here on the aisle. We'll make Justin run.
Thank you. I noticed when you mentioned the condors, there was a reaction in the audience, which I thought was lovely, touching. I happen to really appreciate frogs, who are part of an amphibian realm.
Worse extinctions than the birds at this point.
And there's something strange going on with bees in the last few years. Is there anybody like DiCaprio or anybody who might be a spokesperson and elicit a much larger emotional response from a broader audience than we have here, that's on the frontier or cutting edge of mobilizing more of us to really care using some deeper emotion?
That's a good question, because that would certainly be helpful. I love this little website called Ecorazi. I don't know if you've seen that, that tracks the environmental efforts of our celebrity citizens. It's kind of interesting. DiCaprio is frequently mentioned there. I don't know ultimately how effective that is, because what it does elicit people's reaction are things like you mentioned, the condor or the polar bear. You know, the Center for Biological Diversity people call them the polar bear their rock star. You know, that's because all of a sudden people who wouldn't care about some obscure species becoming extinct, which actually may have more value in terms of, you know, potential cures for cancer or something like the milk vetch. You know, who cares about the endangered Milkovich, but you hear polar bear or emperor penguin because there's been some great movies about, or what?
Pandas.
Yeah, or pandas. That gets people incensed. And it's kind of sad that that's the way we are, but it is. I mean, we like to have a symbol for the cause. And so far, the most effective symbols have been the creatures that are at risk themselves, the landscapes that are at risk themselves. You drive across the Tejon Ranch over the grapevine, you see this amazing terrain, and then picture just throwing down the equivalent, I'm sure, lovely equivalent of Irvine or something in the midst of it. And, I think there are those of us who would look at that and say, cool, and there's others that would be horrified. And my sense is that we're getting more horrified these days than maybe we did 20 years ago, but I have no scientific study to back that up, but I believe that. And the tipping point isn't going to come from a celebrity spokesman, but from this gradual building of momentum to see those kinds of things as horrors rather than progress.
Anybody over here? No? All right. Then what about back here up this lady?
I have two questions. First of all, how did you select the people that you included in your book? And the second one is, do you think we can really trust the government with those public lands that they're giving to them after what Bush did?
Well, the selection was, you could write a set of encyclopedias called the Echo Barons. It was strictly my own subjective choices because, the ultimate conceit of a writer is, oh, if it interests me, it's going to interest everyone else. And so that was my first criteria, interesting people, interesting stories. But I wanted a range. I wanted to be able to define what is an echo baron by a measure not of their bank account but their impact. So I did. We didn't talk about one woman who has very few resources, but lives in the Houston area and pretty much single-handedly with an army of school children writing letters and stuff, fundraising with her, saved sea turtles from extinction in the Gulf of Mexico. No resources to speak of other than her passion. So I wanted the range from the very wealthy like Ted Turner to people like Carol Allen in Houston, who has, in her own way, has had just as much and perhaps more measurable impact than some of the wealthier Echo Barons. So that was my selection criteria, a range of people that anyone could identify with, and then just good stories. Can we trust the government with our public lands? It's trusting ourselves with our public lands. And the thing that we've struggled with over the last 30 years is the difference between private wealth and the commonwealth. I grew up in Pennsylvania. We don't call ourselves a state. We're a commonwealth. I always love that term because it redefines in a very positive way what government is about. It's about the things that private enterprise can't do for us, which is public parks, because you don't make money building a public park, or national monuments, or roads that don't have a toll on them, all the things that make up the commonwealth. We've come through a dark age for the Commonwealth, I think, in the last 20 or 30 years, in which there was a lot of attention and time spent trying to exploit those irreplaceable parts of the public wealth. And I think people are tired of that. I'm tired of it. And those who voted for change, perhaps, were expressing an exhaustion with that philosophy. So maybe we're entering a new stage. It's the first president in 30 years who put energy efficiency and conservation and environmental ideas on the front burners. And the last time Jimmy Carter was on the roof of the White House saying, "Here's my solar panels," and that's a symbol for where we're going to be in the country. I don't know if you know this, but there was a plan in place when he left office to have America 20 to 25% energy efficient by the year 2000, We led the world in renewable energy technology at that time. And all the incentives and all the programs and the support for those industries went away when Ronald Reagan came in and literally tore the solar panels off the roof of the White House. And where could we, I mean, the great communicator could have used his influence to maintain and continue to grow that industry. And where would we be now had we not wasted those 30 years that ensued? But you can't go back. We just can go forward.
Some questions around here. Okay, Jason, you're going to have to go again. This lady, please.
Do you have any good news, being from Pennsylvania? I'm from Maryland. Any good news about the Chesapeake Bay?
I don't. And but I, you know, it's not something that I did a lot of research on, just what I've read from time to time. It seems pretty grim, though. I mean, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how much education is being done in the schools, because isn't that where we should really be focusing attention, teaching the kids who can maybe then influence their parents?
I think our kids, our school-age kids, are much more environmentally aware than young people have been for a long time. So whether it's happening in our schools or in our homes or just through the popular media, I think that's one of the bright spots right now.
Over here, anybody? Back there, this lady, please. Okay.
Hi. When you were talking about Maine earlier, you were talking about maybe people would want to take that forest and build new housing and stuff like that. Is there any movement of people wanting to have smaller houses and live on smaller property and not have eight children and, you know, like live smaller than, you know, having mansions and things?
Yeah, I think it's called the recession.
Yeah, I think we're all headed that way. Well, you know, let's look at California. You know, there's actually been a law in the books since the 1970s that says any environmental impact that a new development has, you have to mitigate it. Well, we're now applying that old law to climate change issues and to greenhouse gas emissions. Now, the question remains how far we're going to go on that front, but conceivably it could change the way we build and change the way we grow, and it's already starting to. Maybe the next big development has to have a zero-emission transportation component or super efficient appliances, or maybe it needs to be closer to existing development than it otherwise would have been. There's an entire spectrum of ways in which we can be greener in how we live, and the laws are actually on the books to compel it. Whether or not we have the will to see those through remains to be seen.
One more question. Going once. Down here, please.
You're just enjoying running him around.
Really? That's why he's so thin. He does this all the time.
Well, I since there was no other questions, I'd like to make a comment, if I may, quite briefly, in response to the woman's question about small houses. There really is a movement. There is a convergence today of the voluntary simplicity movement, the environmental movement, and the communities movement. And that is manifesting itself quite a bit in both urban and rural areas, intentional communities and eco-villages. And I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about that.
Thank you.
Good closing comment.
Thanks, Ed.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.